Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. It was President Benton that suggested that in my first year after doing 30 Bible lectureships, I should teach a class and just walk down memory lane and reflect on some things that happened behind the scenes, some stories I've never told, or what I thought were some of the turning points, some of the things that helped us grow. And so this is just down home. We're just reflecting. And for those of you who have been coming for most of these 30 years, this should be an enjoyable walk down memory lane. So we begin. The phone was ringing in the kitchen of Morehouse, the palatial Pepperdine residence in Heidelberg, Germany. It was the third week in January, 1982, and the voice on the other end of the phone was Howard A. White, the fifth president of Pepperdine University. Jerry, he told me in this transatlantic call, you have often said you would love to direct the Bible lectures. Our current director, Mike Armour, has accepted another job. He's leaving us. I'd forgotten now where Mike was going. I think he had just accepted the presidency of Columbia Christian College and was moving to Portland. You've wanted this job. Do you want to be director of the Pepperdine Bible Lectures? I remember the moment well. I had just turned 39 the month before. I was early in my career at Pepperdine, and here was the challenge that I had wanted for some time. But I didn't say yes. I said, Dr. White, I would be very interested, but I have some requirements. And the first one is big. And this may be a deal breaker. But if I take this job, I want you to trust me, and I want you to let me do it alone and dispense with the committee. There was a long silence. I was on the committee. I know how committees work. And by the time you have all agreed on something, you've got the lowest common denominator. You are not going to have a Bible lecture program that's going to challenge anybody because nobody wants to take a risk. Nobody wants to do anything different. And Abilene had a committee and Harding had a committee and Lipscomb had a committee. That's the way Bible lectureships are done. You got 14 people on a committee and they all want their favorite person to speak that year. And by the time you've honored 14 to 18 people on this committee, you don't have a lot of room to maneuver. What I was asking for was outrageous. I knew it. But I said, if you would trust me to use balance and to use all the church and to be fair, would you let me do it alone? When he found his voice, he said, yes, I would be willing to try that. With the agreement that as soon as I feel like it's not working, we go back to the committee. This isn't a decision for all time. This is, okay, let's get started. But you are asking for something that's never been done. The second request was, would you give me a budget so that I can travel? I don't care how beautiful the booklet is. That doesn't bring people in. I need to go to the churches. I need to preach in their churches. I need to meet people face to face. That's where I'm at my strength. If you will let me have some travel budget so that I can hit the road and build this program. If you're content with the size of the program, then I'm probably not your man. But if you would let me grow this. That one he answered a little quicker. Yes, I'll give you a budget. But I still didn't say yes. I wanted a little time just to pray about it. And so I contacted the closest friends I have. We didn't have email. I just had to write some letters, make some long-distance calls. And I was surprised that when I talked to the people who loved me the most and who were concerned about my future, when I said to them, you know, I've always wanted to do this. What do you think? What do you think? I could be the director of the Bible lectures. What do you think? Be honest with me. They said, we're not sure. I said, what? And more than one of them said the line behind me. Bible lectureships are dinosaurs. They once roamed the church. They were great at Abilene in the 20s, other schools in the 30s and 40s, and by the 50s, they were great everywhere, and they were still roaring through the 60s, but wow, they tapered off in the 70s, and they were replaced by the soul-winning workshops and the Tulsa workshop, and that's where the action was, the soul-winning workshops. By 1982, Bible lectureships had peaked and started down. And they said to me, they're like dinosaurs that once roamed the earth, but they will never come back to roam the earth again. And when I went against the advice of my closest friends, I had to overcome the jaded expectations of a very skeptical church that this could ever come back to life again. When I came home and met with Howard, he handed me the lecture booklet from 1982. The last one before I took over. This had 8 photographs in it, all males. There were, at 1 hour, 4 classes to pick from. At one time, it was sort of mind-boggling at how much there was in here. And I still remember Howard handed me this and said, Jerry, can you maintain this excellent program? And with fear and trembling, I said, Dr. White, I'm going to do my best. I'll give it a try. So I took off, and I started driving through the states. But this is the background I brought to this job. My parents sent me away in the 11th grade. First time I ever left home for any length of time. I was sent to Great Lakes Christian High School in Beamsville, Ontario, Canada, which was 5 hours from my hometown in Detroit, Michigan. I could only get back at Thanksgiving or Christmas. I was away from home at 16 years old in a foreign country singing God Save the Queen before chapel service and all of this. And then in January, an event came that I had never heard of. They started talking about it in December. Lectureship is coming. What's that? Well, you'll see. It takes place in January. And so in January 1960, in the 11th grade, my life changed. I couldn't believe that week. Here they came from all over Ontario, some places in Quebec and Manitoba, people from around the world coming in to this mission point. And exhibit booths were set up all over, and they were advertising mission work. And we all gathered at the Beamsville Church of Christ over on Queen Street, and the singing was thunderous. And I heard preaching and preachers and teachers that I had never heard of before. And when that year was over in 1961, my second year, and in 1962, my third year, grade 13, the first year of college, I got to hear, for example, Willard Collins, that barrel-chested man from Lipscomb University with that roaring voice. I'd never heard anyone like that. I got to hear a young boy preacher in his 20s who was so eloquent that he didn't know how to say, oh, he couldn't have stumbled over a word if he tried. I had never heard a speaker so fluent. His name was Harold Hazlip, and one day he would be the dean of the graduate school at Harding's Graduate School in Memphis, and after that he would become the president of Lipscomb. But now he was the boy preacher from Taylor Boulevard in Louisville, and I sat there mesmerized. And a tall, skinny preacher came out of Northern California, was over at San Leandro or someplace, and his name was Roy Osborne, and he looked like Abraham Lincoln. He was about 6'4", and his hands would come out like this, you know, when he preached, and he had these bony fingers. and his shirt and his jacket would fall open. There was nothing there to him. He was just skin and bones. But, oh my, the stories he could tell and the preaching and the lessons that we heard on restoration history. And when I went from there to Michigan Christian College, the lectureship there was so mission-centered because Otis Gatewood was our president and Maurice Hall was our assistant to the president. These were former missionaries. And then I went down to Oklahoma Christian in my junior and senior year, great lectureships. And in my senior year, I talked to a bunch of fellow students and I said, let's drive down to Abilene and go to the Abilene lectures. And we did in February of 1965. Still makes my heart beat to think of when the car turned on campus court and we started down with the tower of the College Church of Christ looming ahead. We were on holy ground. We were on the holy hill. We were at ACC. And I heard young John Allen Chalk preaching that year in 1965. Lectureships. Oh, they were in my blood. And they were so good through the 60s. Admittedly, 70s, they began to drop off. But when I came to Pepperdine in 78 to be the minister of the University Church of Christ that met in Elkins Auditorium, and I preached my first sermon 35 years ago on April 2nd, 1978, I said to Howard White, who became president just a few months after I arrived, that I had hoped that I hoped that I might be the director of the Bible lecture someday. And he said, well, you're already the preacher for the university church and you're teaching Bible and we got to spread these positions out, you know, not, you can't do all of these things. I said, well, just tuck it into the back of your mind. I'd love to do it. And so the phone call came and I hit the road. First church I went to, Stockton, California. I looked those people in the eye who knew me and loved me, and I said, if you will come next year to the Bible lectures in 1983, and if you will bring 50 people and fill up an entire dormitory, 50 people, that dorm will be yours until Christ returns. I said it with a straight face. They believed it, and they filled it that first year. My second church was San Leandro. My third church was Campbell. And then I was down to Fresno and Bakersfield and Tulare County and San Diego. And before long, we had a Phoenix storm and then an Albuquerque storm and then a Great Northwest storm with Portland, Seattle. That worked. And people began to come. But when that first year, and I'll show it to you now, when that first year came and I put together my program with, boy, was this artistic, huh? Big 40 on there for the 40th lectureship. It looked like a VBS program. And it wasn't much bigger than the program that I'd been handed. It was bigger. And if you could see the pictures of who came that year, it was bigger than what we had had. The whole bottom part of the field house was filled. I don't know, 800-900 people. But nobody was in the bleachers. Nobody was up top. And I was so discouraged. I almost quit that first year. Everybody else was saying, this was so good. I wasn't persuaded. I had worked so hard. And in my juvenile mind, I thought I could fill the place in 1 year. Couldn't be done. And then I didn't know how to run a lectureship. And so when it was over, Howard White called me in and said, Jerry, you did a good job. Good program. But you lost $42,000. Now, if you lose $42,000 again next year, we're going to have to shut this program down. Those were his words. We're going to have to shut this program down. I didn't know how to rent the dorm rooms out. Duh. We're sitting in Malibu, California. So my second year, I charged $10 a bed. Yes. $2.50 a night to stay in Malibu, California. And we had a little bit more in the second year. And in my second year, I went to the book on Ephesians. So when did we get big? Howard White said to me in 1984, after my first 2 years, 83, 84, Jerry, I'm stepping aside next year. We knew that. Howard was already retired from this university when Bill Bonowski left to become the president of the University of Oklahoma. And Howard had to be lured back out of retirement to become president for 7 years when he was already thinking, I'm done. And he came back and gave us seven great years from September 1978 to 1985. And then he chose his hand-picked successor so that when David Davenport became president at the age of 34, there was no younger college president in America among the top 100 universities in America, of which we were one. So it was pretty dramatic to go with young David, the law student. And Howard said to me, in all facetiousness, but I didn't pick up on it, "Well, I'm going to retire next year, Jerry. What date should I retire on?" "What date?" "I don't know. You're asking me what date?" I didn't pick up. "Oh, come on," he said. "Think about it. What would be a good date for me to turn it over to David Davenport?" I'd already asked David to be the opening night speaker of the Bible lectures. April, whatever, 16, I think, 1985. We were doing Hebrews. And he could preach on that, you know, "In the former days, God spoke to the prophets, but now he speaks to us through his son." I mean, wow, what a text. Hebrews 1, 1 to 4. I still didn't pick up. David Howard White stroked his chin and said, "Well, I was thinking that I might, turn it over on maybe Tuesday, April 16. I'm still not quite picturing it. Why, Tuesday? Why would you give up the office at a Tuesday? I mean, don't you close it out on a Friday or Tuesday?" And then it hit me. He is going to set David up to speak on his first day in office as the opening night preacher at the Bible lectures. You want to know how the program became as big as it became? The secret hero here was named Howard White. What a vision he had. And I suddenly realized what he was saying. That night I wrote a script. We called it the Spiritual Inauguration. Howard read the lines from King David, and David Davenport read the lines from Solomon. And I gave lines to Tom Bost. He was chairman of the board. And Charlie Runnels was there to lead a prayer. And Howard White was reading those great lines where he said, "Be strong, my son," as he turned to young David, who was his son. "Be strong in the Lord." And Solomon answers back. David Davenport says, "I will. I will remember." Wow, you could knock us over with a feather. We were filming that moment, the spiritual inauguration. It's how David began his 15-year presidency. And he spoke on closing night in 2000 at the end of his 15-year presidency. Those were the bookends to his 15 years. And so Hebrews year was very significant. This was the most beautiful cover early on. People came to expect us to have beautiful covers after this one, God of Grace and God of Glory. The first time I did an Old Testament book, I came back to the Old Testament on the average of every third or fourth year. We did 8 Old Testament books in my 30 and 22 New Testament. This was the first time to do Isaiah, and we took that photograph right out here in front of the campus. We enhanced it, obviously, with that shaft of light coming out of the cloud. But there was light coming out of that cloud, but we enhanced it. And then this beautiful color, this raspberry color for God of Grace and God of Glory, and this beautiful font and this beautiful ampersand. I think it was the first of the great covers that people came to expect of us. And when I chose my speakers that year, I didn't choose all preachers. I chose the greatest Old Testament scholar in the church, Professor Jimmy Roberts at Princeton University, and David Davenport lovingly, very lovingly, said to me, "I think that's a mistake. Man, he's a great scholar, but you want him to stand up in Firestone Fieldhouse and preach from Isaiah?" Jimmy got up that day, threw out his arms, and described Isaiah 6 like we had never heard it. I mean, this was a man who had walked and lived in Isaiah since he was in high school. And David Davenport, in a moment I will treasure all my life, when the lectures were over, got me aside and said, "Jerry, I will never again question any of your keynote speakers. You just choose who you want." Jimmy bailed me out that year. It was so good. It was a great year. And then, the fifth year, I went to an 8.5 by 11 by booklet, and I did something that was sinful. I used gold here. You can't see the gold, but we put gold. It was the 50th anniversary of the school. You know, it started in 1937, and this was 1987, and I put gold foil under Triumph of the Good News, and that was criticized. Church relations was getting a little too big. Lectureship was getting a little too big. They're spending a little too much on this booklet. We don't need 8.5 by 11. Grumble, grumble, grumble. And the word came down from on high. Go back to the smaller booklets. This was the year, the only year I ever spoke as a keynote, and I didn't want to do it then. But I'd been gone all year in London teaching, as I have been this year. And David just insisted that I had to speak on opening night. But, and I did, but wow, I was coming back having been gone for a year and having a lectureship to run, and that's not a wise thing to do. I did not speak again until last year on closing night when President Benton asked me to say goodbye. I taught a class my first year in Smothers Theater or Elkins. Big 3-day class. That was a mistake. This program's too big. Yesterday I passed Mike Cope. He said, I can't talk. I'm on my way to teach my class. I said, oh, yeah. I made that mistake my first year, too. I said, you won't do it again, Mike. Saw him today. He said, yeah, that's the end of that. It's a big thing to run this program, and it's hard then to teach at the same time. But that was a great booklet, 8.5 by 11, but I had learned my lesson. And back we went to the smaller booklets for quite a few years. We did Matthew. What I remember about that year doing Matthew is that it was the bicentennial of Alexander Campbell's birthday, and I reached out in a big way to many from the independent Christian churches and some from Disciples of Christ, and we never looked back after that. They've been on this program in good numbers since 1988, and many years after that, then we reached out to people in other faith traditions, Richard Mao, the president of Fuller Cemetery, and Scott McKnight has come to teach and so on. But that 1988 was sort of a turning point in reaching out to others from the Restoration Movement. And then I did Exodus in 89. I think that was the first year that Mike Cope, or at least the first time he spoke, I think on opening night. And Mike was not here the first 3 years, but he started coming in about 85. When I think back on how successful this has been, I think what I most want to say today is how many things went right for me, how many blessings. Early on, of course, I had the campus. Who doesn't want to come to Malibu at the end of April, beginning of May? Gorgeous campus. And fortunately, we kept building dormitories as I grew. When we outgrew the housing, they built the Towers dorm. And when I outgrew that, you know, they built Drescher campus. And so the campus kept growing, and that was a great break. But early on, I got some breaks. I needed somebody to really fill Smothers. And I chose a classmate of mine from Oklahoma Christian, Oliver Howard. And we had gone to school together, and I trusted him. He was an elder in Tulsa. He was a lawyer. He was brilliant. He was a good speaker. And he took on the toughest topics I could give him. What was the first issue I faced? Very first year, I was criticized because I didn't follow the pattern of the last 80 years, where you always identify classes taught by women as ladies' classes, classes for ladies only. I just had men and women teaching, and you could go to whatever class you wanted to go to. And, boy, that drew some fire my first year and my second. I don't recall that being an issue after the third year, because I just said to people, don't go to those classes if you're offended by them. You've got so many offerings, but if you think that woman can teach you something, go sit at her feet and learn. She's not usurping anything over you. If you want to learn, go and learn. So that issue sort of went by. But the women's issue was big, and I asked Oliver Howard to do that class entitled Neither Male Nor Female. That was the most requested tape in my first 15 years, I would think, or so. I mean, that was still being requested years later. We just never could quite keep up with the demand for Oliver Howard's 3-day class on neither male nor female. But he also did the class on elders, and he did the class on unity, and the class on church music, and on. I mean, his classes were packed year after year. I got another break when somebody said to me, there's a young guy down in Brazil. He's a young missionary. Hasn't written anything yet, but, you know, he's a comer. His name's Max Licato, and you ought to try to get him. And I said, well, what's his sponsoring church? They said Central in Miami. I've never been to Miami. I don't know anybody in Central. I said, who's there that I would know? And they said, well, the guy that really supports Max is the guy, the founder of Burger King, Bob Forkum. He goes there. So I called the church secretary, and I can't believe she did this. I said, I need to talk to Bob Forkum, and I'm just wondering if you would be kind enough to give me his phone number. And I know that's not proper. I really understand that. But I'm Jerry Rushford, the director of the Bible Lectures. I'm wanting Max Licato to be flown from Rio de Janeiro. And I want to know if Bob would pay for it. I don't have the money. Would you please give me his phone number? And she did. I don't even know her name, but she's blessed in heaven. And her name is in the Lamb's Book of Life. And I called Bob, and he answered. And I said, Bob, you don't know me from Adam, Jerry Rushford at Pepperdine, but I know you love Max Licato. I've never met him myself. I heard he's a bright young boy, and we would love to have him come teach a class at the Pepperdine Bible Lectures, and I can't begin to pay his flight from Rio de Janeiro. Bob, would you fly him from Rio to Los Angeles for us? And he said, Jerry, I would love to do that. Yeah, Max is my boy. I love him. I would just be thrilled to do that. You count on it. And I got a hold of Max, which is why in this booklet, what does Max say in his note to me in the tribute? I don't want to misquote it. So Max in his tribute writes, Jerry, to the man who gave me one of my earliest speaking invitations, thanks for what you've done for all of us, Max. Well, he's talking about that first year when nobody knew who he was and we could put him in a normal classroom. He ended up coming 7 times. The last was 1995, which I'll close with today, and he was so big by then. I said, Max, you have paid any debt you owe to me for flying you from Rio when nobody knew who you was. You've come enough. You're welcome here any year. Whenever you want to come back, let us know. But you've got a bigger ministry now, and you've paid your debt here. And he hadn't been back until 2 days ago when he spoke here at the beginning of this program. So he was here, he hadn't been back in 18 years. But he came 7 years early on, almost back-to-back years. The other break that I got was that in my very first year, I chose as two keynote speakers, Rubel Shelley and Lynn Anderson. And I invited a lot of people over to my living room for the first night, you know, after opening night. And we're sitting in a circle, and I'm just really pumped, you know. I'm 40 years old now, and I'm the director. And we're going around the room just introducing everybody. And when it comes around to Rubel, he says, I can't go any farther. He said, I've just got to get something off my chest. And he looks across at Lynn Anderson, and he says, Lynn, you don't know me, but the way I treated you at the Fried Hartman Lectures and what I said about you there was just sinful, and I'm sorry. I wronged you, and I criticized you. And he had this speech all written out, but he didn't get to finish it. Lynn just got up and walked across the room and threw a bear hug on him and just hugged him. And we're watching this reconciliation in my living room. And I've said to people, the greatest achievement I made in my 30 years was on my opening night. And, you know, we never equaled that again. We brought Rubel Shelley and Lynn Anderson together, and they stayed with me all 30 years. The big issue early on was women in the church. None in the booklet I was handed. In my first year, I had 3 women's photographs. It grew every year. Last year, in my 30th year, 144 women in the program, which was 40%. So the people teaching on last year's program were 40% women, 60% men. For most faith fellowships, for a lot of them, that wouldn't seem like a big deal. For a male-dominated fellowship like ours, that was a pretty major achievement, to gradually grow and grow to where, when I turned it over, 40% of the teaching force of this program was women in the church. That was a big issue. The other break I got was in this whole new invention, which I never would have seen coming, of praise teams. And 1992, I think, is when Ken Young came. And we just put him in Smothers at night, and you couldn't get in, with Hallel leading singing. And it was like that in 93. I forget the first time we put them, one night only, down in the field house. It was either 94 or 95. Many of you were there. Place was packed. Up on the stage go not only Ken, but his wife and his daughter and these women, the praise team. First time in the history of the Church of Christ. And that elder stood up at the back, and we were all seated, and they started singing. And I wish we had a video of it. He slowly walked all the way down where everybody knew I was sitting. And they knew why he was coming. And I loved him dearly. and he came to me and he had his finger like this and he was letting me know he didn't like this one bit, you know. And everybody was watching it. But you know, 5 years later, he came back to me and he apologized. And he said, you know, I see it from a different perspective. That's not what I want. We're not going to do that in my congregation, but if other congregations want to have it, I want to give them that liberty. And he apologized. He was a great man. He was a mayor of his city in California, and I loved him. I had preached up there where he was at, and I loved him even as he was humiliating me in front of 4,000 people and really taking me to task. But that was a turning point when Ken Young and Hallel came along. I built my program on 10 speakers. We produce great preachers in Churches of Christ. Say what you want. We know how to preach. And here's who I ended up building on. Who gave the most keynotes? You already know this. Mike Cope, 8. Rick Atchley, 7. Randy Harris, Rubel Shelley, Chris Smith, 6 each. Len Anderson, David Fleer, Don McLaughlin, Harold Shank, Jeff Walling, 5 each. There's 58 keynotes from 10 speakers that really put us on the map. I was just wise enough to invite them. So with this great singing and the great involvement now of women coming through the years, and we filled up that 1985 and we never looked back. We were full every year after that. But I had a crisis in 1994. That was the year we did Galatians. So let me catch up there. We did Timothy. Remember that great year with Remember Jesus Christ and the Greek behind it. And then we did A God So Near. And the person walking down that road down there, that's Bill Henniger, being photographed by Ron Hall. You know, you got to use what you got, and that's what I had. This is on a road just not far from the campus, just back here behind the hills. But we wanted to get that light coming through, that sun coming through the trees, a God so near. Great themes from the book of Deuteronomy. And then tell me the story, the gospel according to Mark. But this year, crucified with Christ, Galatians is always tough. And that year was tough. It's a tough message. And there were some people who disagreed with some of my keynotes and some people who went to classes they didn't like, and there was grumbling. And even my best friends were beginning to say, let's bring back the committee. And I would not have served under a committee. So that was the year this almost ended. I was wounded, but David Davenport hung in with me. But it was touch and go. I knew I had to come back in 95 with great strength. And let me think where I see if I brought that with me. I had always wanted to put together a Bible lectures program based on the Upper Room Discourse. You got 5 chapters in your red letter Bible, and they're all red letters. Jesus talking for 5 chapters. You got the foot washing story at the beginning, right? And the call for unity in John 17. I chose Rubel Shelley to do the foot washing story. We opened with that. I asked Max Licato to give the clarion call for unity. That was such a spiritual year, such a beautiful year. It was a turning point. Nobody ever questioned my leadership after that. And the next year, we went to 8.5 by 11 booklets. And, you know, the church relations had arrived. And so this year right here, Bill Henniger did these great, great booklets. We went everywhere looking for that Muslim cloth, you know, and that bowl and that chalice and that bread. Ron Hall took all these photos. Bill Henniger was the designer until Rick Gibson came along and started with these great designs in 1999. Then he and Bill did some together. But that was a great year. On closing night, Max wanted to appeal to us to reach the wider Christian world, to have fellowship with a wider Christian world. But to do it, he first needed to say how much he loved this fellowship. And by then, you know, he was big, 1995. I mean, he was, as Christianity Today called him, America's preacher. I mean, he was the most famous preacher in the country. And he was filling the Georgia Dome and wherever he would preach. And so for me to bring him in 95, but he came that one last time because I had said to him, it's John 17. So I'm going to show you a clip of that night. We're going to go back 18 years. And here's Max Licato in Firestone Fieldhouse 18 years ago. And I've pulled out the little clip where he's talking about the Church of Christ that he was raised in West Texas. And he's talking about some of the great teachers he studied under at Abilene Christian, like Dr. Tom Albright and Dr. Neil Lightfoot. And it's a pretty dramatic moment. So are you ready for this? We're going to do a little walk down memory lane. We're going to even dim some lights now. So
I grew up in a small West Texas Church of Christ. You've probably been there. It's a little town in between Wink and Tarzan, just outside of No Trees. You've probably all been there. It's a very humble church made up of oil field workers. My father was an elder in that church. That church had a lot of weaknesses. Church had a lot of struggles. Went through a lot of preachers. But let me tell you something, folks. Those doors were open every Sunday. There was a Sunday school teacher waiting for me every Sunday. And somebody was there to teach me about Jesus every Wednesday night. And though the preacher didn't get paid much, he stayed eventually. And he preached. And I can remember him telling me what Romans 6 meant. And I can remember him explaining why Jesus died on the cross. And though we didn't have a youth minister, some of the men who would work long hours all day long out in the oil fields would come in and take a quick bath and run up to the church so the kids would have a place to go on Friday nights. I found a family in that little church. And there was a time when I fell away from my faith. And there was a time when I did things that a Christian should not do. And I know they knew what I was doing because in a small town, everyone knows what everyone does. But when I realized what I was doing and I walked that aisle, they met me, some of those men, with tears in their eyes. They loved me home. Friends, it was not a church that would be recognized in any major magazine, but let me tell you, it's a church I'll never forget because it is where I came to know the Nazarene. And you know what else I learned? After I left that church and went to college, I found that there were colleges within Churches of Christ who would give me not only an education, but spiritual orientation. I found that there were teachers who would take cuts in salary for the privilege of teaching Bible class to a bunch of freshmen and sophomores and juniors. And when God got a hold of my heart and began lifting my eyes up out of this nation, pointing me toward Brazil, I found that there were teachers already on the campus who had already been there. And they were just waiting on me. And when I had questions, they had answers. And when I called that little church in West Texas and said, I want to go to Brazil, they didn't ask me why. They said, how much? And they wrote me a check. And they sent me to Brazil. And when I came back, I met other teachers. And when I went and told the graduate department at Abilene Christian University that I wanted to stay and I wanted to change my major. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a preacher. They said, great, enroll in our graduate school. And they paid my way. And I sat under the greatest teachers that I have ever met. Men like Dr. Albright. Men like Dr. Lightfoot. Men who put a passion for me, within me, for God's Word that I promise is not extinguished 20 years later.
Well, that was a great night, and the place was, as you can imagine, absolutely packed. We had we put it on the screen in Elkins, the previous Elkins, not this building. And it was after that I said to Max that you have paid your debt to us. You're always welcome to come back, but we understand that you have so many other places to go. In closing, I would say, I have been so greatly supported by five of the seven presidents of this university. I never knew Batsel Baxter. He only served the first 2 years. I knew Hugh Tyner, but not in a close way, and I wasn't really director of the Bible lectures yet. But the three that I served under, Howard White, David Davenport, and Andy Benton, were so supportive of a program that was a little risky. And the two previous ones, Norval Young and Bill Bonowski, wrote me letters and phone calls and held my hand up. I want to close with this, because I think this is the most important thing I wanted to say in the first day, and I hope you come back tomorrow. We'll pick up with 1996. We'll pick up with back to the 8.5 by 11 booklets. When I went to meet with Howard White for the first time at Brockhaus after he had invited me, when I came home around September 1, 1982, and I went into his office, he officed up there at Brockhaus, and we sat down, he said, "Well, you're my director of the Bible lectures." And he handed me, you know, that little booklet and said, "Can you maintain this?" And we talked about what I would do. And I talked about my desire to travel among the churches. And I promised to have balance, to have all segments of the church. But I said to him when he asked this question, "So what are you going to do with the program? How are you going to do it?" I said, "Dr. White, I would like to position it responsibly, a little left of center." "Why?" "Because we're at Pepperdine. We're in California. People think we're going to put it there anyway. We have several of our Bible lectureships that are pretty obviously right of center. Some are struggling to be very centrist. We need one program of all of our programs that just challenge us. And I think Pepperdine needs to be that one. But the key word is responsibly. I want to position it responsibly, a little left of center." Early on, a group of preachers knew that I was flying to Sacramento. And I would be speaking up there, and they knew the motel I would be staying in. They paid me a visit in the motel and tried to browbeat me. They'd already seen my first couple of programs and didn't like it. And I think they really thought they could overwhelm me. And I loved those men. I love them now. Several of them are dead now, but some are still living, and I hope we have good relations. But I said to them, "I am trying to achieve balance. And you're looking at this from the balance, from your background in the Deep South or the Midwest, and so this doesn't look balanced to you, but it is balanced." And I held my ground there. In later years, a delegation demanded that I be put on trial in front of David Davenport, and so he heard them out. He heard them out for 2 hours, I don't know. But when it was over, after I had been really grilled, and boy, he's done this, and this is wrong, David said, "I've heard you out. I gave you time. Out of a busy schedule, I've given you a lot of time. But we think Jerry is balanced. He certainly has prayed to be balanced. He's working very hard to be balanced. And I think he has achieved it. And I back him. And you may go now." So that's the support I've had of these presidents backing me and giving me strong strength. So it's been a great 30-year run. I had a lot of blessings, a lot of things that went right. I had people to build on that were so strong. And now tomorrow we'll pick up with this year, which was the other turning point. Having survived the Upper Room Discourse and we had a good year, now I turned, it was time to go back to the Old Testament. I called Mike Cope and said, "I'm going to do Job. What do you think?" And Mike Cope said to me, "Jerry, there's only one sermon in Job. It's a good one. But all seven," I was asking him to be one of the keynotes, "all seven of us can't give that same talk." I took that under advisement, but I thought, no, we can. So we opened that year with Jeff Walling. Do you remember it? Job's three friends with wireless microphones scattered in the auditorium. questioning Job, you know, and we didn't know where the voices were coming from. Pure Jeff Walling, pure theater. Just, you know, these voices saying to Job, "You have sinned, what have you done?" And Job, "No, no, I haven't." And wow, you didn't leave that lectureship thinking, boy, that wasn't unusual. That was pure Jeff Walling on opening night. And that was called Out of the Whirlwind. And we did this artwork, you know, Bill painted, having this gray and then using the muted yellow. The next morning, Ronnie Norman on God on Trial. And that night, Jim McGuigan, Life on the Ash Heap, in which he preached about his beautiful wife, Ethel, the paraplegic. How hard that was. And I mean, we wept and we laughed. We wept and we laughed as Jim talked about life with Ethel. And then on Thursday morning, Mark Frost, with friends like these, .. You know, who needs enemies when you got the friends Job has? And then on Thursday night, Mike Cope, and it was called, Though He Slay Me, Yet Will I Serve Him, Though He Slay Me. And then on Friday morning, as we began to wrap up, Bill Long's title of his talk was Better Than Answers. Job didn't get answers to his questions, but he got something better. And finally at the end, Tim Woodruff closed it with, His hand is upon us both, which was a quote from Job. His hand is on us both. What a year. And that's where we pick up tomorrow. I wish I had the video, and maybe it's out there. I've been in London, I just got back. I didn't have time to find it. But I hope we videoed it. But we, you know, there were many years we didn't video. And if we have it, David Gaylor videoed it, but he has Alzheimer's now. I need to get his wife and say, did you happen to video 96? Because I would love to have the clip of Mike Cope at the end when he said, what will I say to this God? The death of my 10-year-old Megan. When I stand before this God, what will I say to this God? And that was our question. All of Firestone Fieldhouse was hushed, wondering, what do you say to this God? And Mike took a step back and began to sing, You are beautiful. How does it go? Beyond what? Yeah. And then he motioned to us to stand. And we all sang together. I'd love to find that clip, but I don't have it tomorrow. But that's where we pick up tomorrow with 1996, and we close with last year, 2012. Thanks for coming. Have a good day.